Welcome back to the programme. Well, in recent weeks, stories from Northern Ireland have returned to the headlines for a variety of reasons, from good news stories like the return of Channel 4's comedy Derry Girls to comments made by the Northern Ireland Secretary of State Karen Bradley in relation to security force killings. To discuss all these stories is the author and journalist and Derry woman, Susan McKay. Do you watch?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm one of the people who's currently already fretting because there's only going to be five more episodes in this series, you know, okay. And I don't know how I'm going to live when it ends.
OK, well, just for those that haven't, we have a tiny clip.
OK, so this is just a little exercise I like to kick off with. I want you guys to give me examples of things that Catholics and Protestants have in common and things that they don't have in common. Let's start with similarities.
Protestants are British and Catholics are Irish.
So that's actually a difference. Quite a big difference. If that's okay, we can write that down. Now, back to similarities.
Protestants are richer.
Okay, so that's another difference.
Catholics really buzz off statues and we don't so much.
I do enjoy a good statue, it has to be said.
So again, what we have there is a difference.
Oh, Protestants like to march and Catholics like to walk.
What about the fact that we all feel and love and hope? I just want to think along those lines for a moment.
Catholics watch RTE.
Protestants love cleaning.
Protestants are taller.
Catholics have more freckles.
Protestants hate ABBA.
Okay, thank you. Let me just rephrase slightly. Can you think of anything that unites every single person in this room? Is there anything that we all want?
For this to be over.
And we'll wrap it up there.
It is terrific. I have to say, I fell in love with the nun who likes a good statue. I thought that was a great line. Anyway, it has been a remarkable success. How's it going down in Derry?
Amazing. I mean, if you go for a walk through Derry at the moment, you're likely to meet somebody within a very short time who will want to recite an entire episode, joke by joke, to
right.
you and fall about laughing at it all over again, plus adding in all the jokes they've read on social media since that have spun off from the series. And as for Sister Michael, I mean, there's going to be a statue of her in Derry before this series is out. It's just unbelievable how brilliant it has been for Derry.
Well, given the question about similarities, do Protestants like Derry Girls?
Yes, Protestants do like Derry Girls, but I'm afraid we don't agree with some of the stereotypes in Derry Girls. In that segment the other night, one of the aspects mentioned highlighting differences between Derry use of pejorative terms, tags and prods.
Yes.
I think
it's
one of the differences is that Protestants allegedly keep toasters in cupboards. Well, being a Protestant,
there's
I
a
can assure
a
you
press.
I never get the toaster in the cupboard. What I use the cupboard for is storing my secret stash of O'Neill's football shirts.
It does mean, though, if you don't have any toaster at all, does that mean you're an atheist?
Well, that's a very, very good point. But another point they made was that Catholics have more freckles than Protestants. Well, I'm very much Protestant. So I am the ultimate freckle monster.
They used to say that Protestants had better skin than Catholics. I don't know if they still
say
that.
Yeah, that's another one as well. Like, I know people who are up in Donegal, they always thought I was Protestant because I'm 6 foot tall and I have very clear skin. I was like, no,
well
my family's Catholic.
Yeah, no.
I thought
it goes back to the Protestants are richer thing that
Pardon?
She says. It's the Protestants are richer thing that she says.
More
in that
food. I'm actually from a Derry Protestant background, and the first time that I met Nell McCafferty in person, she said to me, oh, you look as if you were reared on champagne and oysters. You know? Which I definitely don't and definitely wasn't. But
another interesting point is that the city of Derry stroke Londonderry, of course, is very, very important in unionist culture in Northern Ireland. There are many, it's been highly controversial, of course, over the years, but thankfully now the apprentice boys and non-citizen and residents have come to an agreement, and that very important
thing
it takes part every year. So there's a positive relationship developing in the city. And the organisation, the Loyal Order, is called the Apprentice Boys of Derry. But just if we could add a little codicil, a little personal codicil, some of you may have seen, whenever I came in this morning, I was carrying my ukulele. It's out in the green room, not in the studio here, but I played play the ukulele at the drop of a hat. A couple of months ago, I was up at an event at the Guildhall in Derry, and I had my ukulele with me as always, and I could not resist going up to the walls and doing a few verses of Derry's Walls. So I might post that on my YouTube channel at some stage in the future.
How did that go, Jack?
I think one of the things that Derry Girls has been really brilliant at is that it's able to make jokes about sectarianism, and that's really, really hard to do.
Yeah.
And there was a great thing during the week where the newsletter, and I'm not sure if it was a spoof piece or whether it was just a band having fun, but they had this piece about a loyalist flute band from some very hardline County Down place, which took umbrage, allegedly, that about the slur that no Protestants liked ABBA, you know. And they said, we can confirm that this is nationalist propaganda, and there are two members of our band who love ABBA. Yeah. You know, so it's actually bringing out the best.
It really is great to be able to laugh at scary things, isn't it?
I think the best scene in that first show of the new series was the blackboard when they were finished.
The
similarities had nothing. The differences was just completely covered over.
Yeah.
And Sister Michael has definitely the best lines. And the one I like best was when someone had ratted on their school pal, said, you'll go far, but you won't be popular.
Well, I mean, the thing is as well, it covers the generations, because I grew up in Derry in the 70s, and we went through all that bridge building and forced encounters of the third kind with Catholics and all that, you know. But the thing is, we also had the same sort of fascination with the other side, and we were all convinced that the boys or girls of the other side were far more sexy than the boys or girls of our own side, you know. And that has obviously persisted right through to the 90s. And, you know, my teenage diaries are full of the same sorts of things as, you know, in Derry Girls, you know, like I actually found a diary entry which said something about, you know, there was a bomb scare on the bridge. I didn't get to see so-and-so, you know. I mean, the troubles were always just, they were part of your life, but they were there in the background, and your hormones were considerably more important a lot of the time.
I really must ask, Susan, did you write that entry into your diary or into your London diary? just another very, very brief point about Derry. I have to admit that I love the accent, but within the city there's a variety of accents. So, but in the main, the Derry accent is absolutely wonderful, except when it goes horribly wrong. And I suppose the ultimate example I could give of the Derry accent going horribly wrong and becoming and being transformed from the thing of beauty into a thing of absolute repulsiveness would be Nadine Coyle's mid-Atlantic accent.
Oh, no.
Derry girls have to go to Derry for mid-Atlantic accents, I can assure you.
The clip of Nadine Coyle talking about flour is now really, really popular thanks to Derry Girls as well. But I think one of the other things, Marion, is people love the actresses. I mean, it's a brilliant script. Lisa McGee is a genius. You know, just every bit of it is pitch perfect. But also people love the fact that the actresses have become public figures and they've come out in support of women's right to choose and things like that. They've been very vocal in the public domain and people just love them.
And there are murals and tours now.
Yes, and people are going. I was in Derry a few weeks ago working with a French-Iranian journalist, and she wanted to have her photograph taken with the Derry Girls mural rather than the Free Derry Wall mural. So, you know, it's just brilliant.
Right. Well, we've got to move on to more serious things, sadly. And this is Karen Bradley and her comments on Bloody Sunday. What was your own reaction to that?
I thought it was absolutely shocking and outrageous. And, you know, I think that it's indicative of just how utterly indifferent the Tory government in the UK is the majority of citizens in Northern Ireland.
But nobody in the House of Commons took her up on it. I mean, nobody.
Well, I think it's a measure of how sad it is that Mark Durkan isn't there anymore, because Mark Durkan would have taken her up on it, and Mark Durkan
would have made sure. Bernadette Devlin would have.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to fancy her chances if Bernadette had been there and she'd said that. But no, it was a disgraceful thing to say, and it's really incredible that she's still in office and that the Tories don't even seem remotely concerned about
what she said. I presume.
And particularly given the fact that the Ballymurphy inquest was going on at the same time, and, you know, people are hearing this really harrowing evidence from people whose relatives who were just ordinary civilian people in an area that was an uproar, who were killed or injured, that those people were giving evidence at the same time as she was making those crass remarks.
You worked on the border, Owen, didn't you, when you were in the Defence Forces?
I did, yeah, I did.
And I mean, there have been all sorts of comments made during the week that if an IRA bomber is convicted, he'll be protected, or she will be protected under the Good Friday Agreement to a maximum of 2 years in prison. But if a soldier were convicted, no such thing. I think that came from Boris Johnson. If you're working in those circumstances, how does it operate?
Well, for professional armies, and the British Army, is, and it's one you're referring to now, is a professional army, soldiers going on patrol or on duty are always read their orders, and you'll hear the patrol commander, and I can, I'm nearly 20 years gone out, but I can always hear the patrol commander articulating to his group of 10, 12 lads, you know, when they can open fire legally under firing. You know, it's in defence of your own life. But there are other conditions then that are applied to. You know, you must issue a warning, fire containing shots if you're in certain areas, certainly fire warning shots. And it's only when there is an immediate threat. And at the very end of it all, you'll hear the commander say, does everyone understand the order? And they... That's been repeated. It's nearly like a mantra. It's been repeated ad nauseam. I am sure patrols going on the British Army would have, you know, had the same. Because if you read Paul Anthony McDermott's article in the
Business Post, I think.
I think it's Sunday Times.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Sunday Times today. He minds that the basic legal tenet in Ireland and the UK is that soldiers are subject to the ordinary law of the land. If they unlawfully kill a person in the course of their duty, they are not, they don't enjoy immunity and are liable to be charged with murder. And that is why those orders are given, to say, have you covered your back, as it were, before you fire ball ammunition towards people? And that is now, but the whole issue at play here is that we're not talking about soldiers conducting what were carrying out lawful orders. You know, were they given unlawful orders or were there no orders given at all? And that's why people want inquiries into the Bloody Sunday thing. And the big difficulty thing is now, that's coming up this week.
Yep.
Paul Anthony McDermott also makes the point, it is so long ago by the time this actually ends up in court that in all other courts it might be dismissed because it is would be impossible to have a fair inquiry.
You know the guy that was in charge on the day?
No, not the guy that was in charge. I came across an unfortunate name given the week that we're having, General Sir Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
He ended up which is a kind of an aside story to this whole thing. Nobody's suggesting that General Sir Michael Jackson did anything wrong at all. But he was I'm certainly not. He was the adjutant of the paratrooper unit, and he ended up being the most... he is probably the most infamous or better known British Army officer since the Second World War. But he was a young captain in Derry on that week. Now, if there is an inquiry, you could have the situation as the chief of staff of the British Army, former second in command, I think, in NATO, given evidence at it. You know,
and
as to what
would
happened
be wrong with that?
No, but that,
if it's relevant.
Absolutely nothing wrong. But I'm trying to say, people are saying, all of this is going to come out in the wash. This is what the inquiry would bring up. And they already know what Savile has found, that these soldiers acted unlawfully in certain. So not only there's nobody, he's not going to be charged, this General Sir Michael Jackson, but he could be required to give evidence as to what happened.
If you describe it that the person in charge, as you say, by rote, goes over it and over it and over it, what the rules of engagement are non-engagement are, why wouldn't the senior person?
Well, if they're found to have neglectful in their duties, yes, they should be. What I'm saying is just this is the political scenario that is playing out, and that's why perhaps people may be reluctant at higher political office level. That's what I'm merely making.
Yeah.
I'm not kind of making excuses for him or anything, but it is just another addendum to this story, that's all. But Sir Michael Jackson, you will recall during the... when the NATO went across into Kosovo, he refused an order by the commander of the NATO forces, an American officer, to go and block the Russians taking the airport in Pristina. And remember, the Russians rushed from Sarajevo, took the airport in Pristina. He was ordered by his commander to block it, and he refused to do so. He said, I'm not going to start World War III on behalf of the Americans. For that term, he became known as Wacko Micko. He then subsequently came home and got promoted chief of staff of the British Armed Forces.
You wanted to come back.
Yeah, and just on that point from Paul Anthony McDermott's piece where he talks about the law in the UK and Ireland, it's not just UK and Ireland, it's public international law. It governs any troops stationed across the world. And with Karen Bradley's statement, one that has literally gone under the radar is Gavin Williamson, who was the Minister for Defence, who said that these soldiers were under a witch hunt. Now, considering the timing that's there, considering the position he's in, along
and
with
the fact
Karen Brady,
that there's a decision coming out
exactly,
next week.
Again, there was a brilliant cartoon on the Sunday Times with a row of ministers trundling along on their hands because all their feet were all in their mouth, which underlines the entire situation.
And the decision that the Crown Prosecution Service has to make in the North, whether there will be an inquiry into this, it could end up with 17 retired British troops being charged with the offences, including murder.
Yeah, and there's four people. I think, Marion, what you brought up there, the Boris Johnson piece in the Telegraph last Sunday.
Yeah.
So he was writing about, you know, IRA men maybe not getting sentences, whereas these British soldiers will. And so Karen Bradley's comments came in the wake of that. And I think that piece went a little bit under the radar. But what she was saying, she was just repeating what Boris Johnson. So this was more of a Conservative Party ploy, I think, more than her just putting a foot in.
From the perspective, from your perspective, tell me your attitude to the timing of this.
Well,
given the decision that's coming up, explain to the listeners the decision that's coming up.
Well, the decision that's coming up is whether or not the soldiers will be prosecuted. But there's lots of other decisions going around at the moment. I mean, probably some of the listeners will have also heard Julie Hambleton on the radio earlier talking to Miriam and, you know, very forcefully articulating her own sense of terrible grievance against the British government for the way that the victims of the Birmingham bomb have been treated. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who are sort of waiting to hear about inquests and inquiries and criminal trials and so on. But what it all comes down to my mind, is that there has been a real failure by the British government and by the politicians in the North to agree some sort of set of legacy mechanisms which will deal properly with these complex historic cases. Because, you know, we've got a crisis in policing at the moment, with the Police Service of Northern Ireland losing the confidence of the nationalist community, the police ombudsman involved in controversy with the PSNI. And, you know, the criminal justice system, including the coroner's courts, are not really capable of dealing properly with these cases. I mean, I heard Kevin Winter on Miriam earlier talking about people having to use the law to agitate for change, and that's not how the law should have to be used. So I think facing up to the past is a really important thing in a general way the North at the moment, and certainly Karen Bradley has made matters an awful lot worse.
Yeah, if I could come to you, Ian. Obviously, it's interesting to hear the unionist perspective on this, because even in the negotiations to get things going in Stormont again, the legacy issues came up, as well as abortion and the Irish language and all of that kind of thing. What's your perspective on that?
Legacy issues in Northern Ireland are probably one of the most intractable problems that we have. We can talk about an Irish Language Act that can be resolved. We can talk about questions of same-sex marriage, abortion. I think those issues can be resolved ultimately by agreement. I think it'll be much more difficult to bring an agreement in terms of legacy issues. And whenever the Good Friday Agreement was being crafted, a lot of issues were left deliberately vague. In other words, it was a bit like kicking the Brexit can down the road. We've reached the point now that we think where legacy issues have come to a head. And it just shows that, and to a certain extent, the Good Friday Agreement was built on very shaky foundations.
Well, don't you have to fudge?
Agreement.
You know, to get very difficult things across the line, do you not have to depend on fudge? That
creative ambiguity.
Yes, yeah, right.
That's
it. Said,
stay with the legacy and the victims issue. It's such a difficult issue in Northern Ireland. We often talk about a hierarchy of victims, and is one set of victims more important than another set of victims? And
if they're your victims, they are.
Exactly. I like to sit here and say, I'm reasonably honest, say no, they're not. There is no hierarchy. hierarchy of victims. But whenever you look at it, there is, because deep down, I think I would take a different view of the victim status of someone who, someone from the IRA, for example, who's going out to shoot a soldier, or maybe my father in the back who got killed in the course of that. Would I regard him as being a victim? On the other hand, would Republicans look upon the nine who were killed in Loch Gall by the SAS on their way? Would they look upon those as victims? Yes, I'm sure they would. It's a very, very confusing situation, but we have made improvements in a very, very strange way. We'll look at Bally Murphy. We'll look at Bloody Sunday. Bloody Sunday, David Cameron came out and apologised. I think what happened there was that at the time, probably unionists would have had a pretty strong view on that. I think the passage of time has proven that right. those people were innocent.
So, okay, can I come to you? Oh, no, you don't. I come back to you, Susan. But are people looking for resignations and all of that? And what, it's the same kind of question I'm putting to Ian. What do the people of Derry, in your view, want?
Well, obviously the people in Derry want very different things, because the unionist community in Derry doesn't want the same thing by and large as the nationalist community in relation to these things. But I think that the people, we can all agree that the people whose views count most in relation to this are the victims of Bloody Sunday, who everybody now knows were completely innocent of any wrongdoing and were killed on the streets of Derry all those years ago. And their families are quite divided about it. I mean, some of the family, the Bloody Sunday families want prosecution, some of them don't.
That's the point. Like, if you take these young soldiers, and I mean, some of them are very, very young soldiers. We don't know what proper protocols are. Would they unanimously want them prosecuted?
No, they wouldn't. And in fact, there are posters in Derry at the moment that are calling for the prosecution of General Sir Mike Jackson because of his role on Bloody Sunday. And in some ways, what Karen Bradley said kind of played into that, because she was saying all these people were doing was following orders, you know, and so therefore we should be looking at the class of person who gave orders in relation to these things. And I mean, of course, the complexity about this thing is as well that it isn't true to say that members of the security forces were only involved in less than 10% of the killings, because the question of collusion skews all the figures. We don't know how many loyalist killings also involved security forces and indeed the political
and
classes.
And there's the Finucane case just recently again.
There are reports that the British government are going to change laws that it will bring the statute of the limitation to 10 years.
Yeah.
And if they do that in the wake of this decision, this will be the last decision that could be made in terms of things that happened in the Troubles. So instead of having a FUD, you have a very distinct blanket ban on this ever happening again. So I think the British government are definitely on that side. And if when you hear Karen Bradley's comments, it goes totally against the spirit of David Cameron's apology in 2010. Yes. So there's been a significant shift.
But you know, when we were talking about equality of esteem for offences and tragedy and hurt and all of that, you have to remember Arlene Foster's background too. I mean, it really visited her family. And so when you say, well, the biggest tragedy is my tragedy, or the biggest injustice is against my family. You know, sorry, you weren't going, Jennifer.
Just on the point that was made there about the legislation for the 10-year limitation on members of the British forces that were there, that at the end of the day, they were professional soldiers that were being paid by the Crown. So therefore, they should be subject to a higher duty of care or a higher standard than the people who would have been from the different terrorist organisations, because they were just kind of gangs. There was no professionalism about that, whereas the British forces were professional soldiers.
They achieved a lot of their aim in terms of killing and bombing. I mean,
they did.
Let's not rewrite history on that.
That they have the 2-year limitation, but the thing is, the British forces that were in there as part of the British state.
Right. Now, come back and give the final word to you, Susan. Do you think she should resign? Do you think she will resign? Do you think she will be fired?
Yes, she should resign. No, I don't think she will. And no, I don't think she'll be fired. I think Theresa May is only interested in her loyalty at the moment.
Right.
Agreed.
Pardon?
I completely agree. Just make one very, very brief point.
Briefly,
Karen Bradley gets herself into a huge amount of trouble for some of the potentially crass things that she'd said. Her predecessor, James Brogan, got himself into trouble for never getting into trouble. He took no part in the development of the peace process or advancing the cause of Northern Ireland in any shape or form. So sometimes you...
Bring back Mo Mola.
And Paul Andrew McDermott has told Karen Bradley to go watch Derry Girls, which I think is great advice.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, on that, we'll take a break.